Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. The speaker this afternoon will be Mike, and I'm not. So thank you for your attention, and thank you for your presence here this afternoon. I'm Dennis Danielson, a member of the English Department at the University of British Columbia, and I'm also a long-standing member. I don't know if I'm a member of good standing, but I am a long-standing member of the Graduate and Faculty Christian Forum, which is sponsoring the event this afternoon together with the Pew Foundation, which is kindly providing funding and support. Before I introduce the speaker for this afternoon, I have a few other announcements. One is that there is another lecture next week, which will be held not here, but we hope, in Buchanan Penthouse. It's in Buchanan B. It's just across there behind the defense picket lines at the moment. Next week's speaker will be Dr. Roger Lundeen from Wheaton College. His topic will be nimble believing. That's nimble believing. Modern literature and the conflict of interpretations. There will also be another lecture this evening at Regent at 8 o'clock, also given by Dr. Miroslav Wolf, whom it's now my pleasure to introduce. Oh, I've actually forgotten a few other things. I'm going to eventually get around to this afternoon's speaker. I've been asked to mention that there's a sign-up email list on the back table, that there is a table also with books on it for your perusal afterwards, and that the CD of this afternoon's lecture and of this evening's lecture, by the way, which will be called Living With the Other, will be available through Regent College. So if any of that is unclear, please don't ask me afterwards. Ask Gordon Carpenter, who's sitting at the back. Miroslav Wolf is Henry B. Wright Professor of Systematic Theology at the Yale Divinity School. I think it was about this time last year we had the privilege of hearing a colleague of his from Yale Divinity School, I'm his son, and so I hope that we're on the kind of annual calendar of members of Yale Divinity School. Miroslav Wolf is a theologian. He has a remarkably rich background. He was born in Croatia. And I've got to tell you that reading his curriculum vitae is an exercise in humility, seeing how much such a young man
has
accomplished. He has published in three languages, at least, that I recognize here, a Croatian, a German, and English. And one of the things that strikes me when I'm looking at his titles, the titles of his books, is that if he's actually made up his own book titles, he's also a bit of a poet around the edges. And he has a book in German called Zukunft der Arbeit, Arbeit der Zukunft. Lovely. The future of work, the work of the future. He has written books on a large, overarching human philosophical themes of justice. Another poetic title, Exclusion and Embrace, a theological exploration of identity, otherness, and reconciliation. What timely themes these are. A Passion for God's Reign, Theology, Christian Learning, and the Christian Self is one of the books that he has edited. As I say, he comes originally from Croatia. He received his tertiary education in Croatia and in Germany. He has the Dr. Theol at the University of Tübingen, where he also received his habilitation in 1994. This is a kind of supercharged extra doctorate that people who study in Germany have to acquire before they can really be a professor. He's done all that. And we are so delighted to have him in this place and at this difficult time. Professor Miroslav Volk, I heartily welcome you to UBC. I look forward to hearing your lecture this afternoon. Struggles in Religious Identity. Is Christianity a Violent Religion? Professor Volk, will you join me in welcoming?
I'm also thinking of this one.
Well, is that better now? Oh, wait a second. I need to turn this thing on and then I'll, okay.
Can you hear
me back there? Okay, wow. I can hardly imagine something less poetic than that. I think when the organizers saw me dressed the way I am, they decided I need some kind of a tie substitute, and so they put all these mics. Anybody else with a mic I can hang here? No, okay. So, is Christianity a violent religion? This is the main focus of my talk. Well, I was going to make some introductory comments about Newsweek article that I read on Bush and God and how I almost changed my mind about the topic, about the thesis that I'm developing here in the light of this, but I won't go there. We can discuss it later. Okay. So basically what I'm going to do, I will in introduction talk about the kind of resurgence of religion on the public scene, and then ask the question, well, is that for good or for ill, and explore the question, how do we need to address and understand religions in relationship to the public sphere or private sphere in terms of its consequence upon kind of societies, its ability to sustain cultures of peace or contribute to violence. And then I'm going to propose an unusual thesis and try to defend it, and we'll see what happens afterwards. You're going to challenge me, okay? So, introduction. In the aftermath of the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center, it was not unusual to hear that the attack has, as it was said, changed everything. Everything is certainly an exaggeration, but 9/11, as the terrorist attack is sometimes called, did change a good many of things, including our relation to religion. For the attack in which more than 3,000 lives were lost and the economic life of the nation was disrupted in a major way was in part motivated by religion. Religion, we were led to conclude, is alive and well today and is a force not only in private but also in the public lives of people around the globe. Now, this is not what the mainstream sociologists of the 20th century, who followed in the footsteps of Karl Marx, Max Weber, or Emil Durkheim, were predicting. Instead of slowly withering away or lodging itself quietly into the privacy of worshippers' hearts, religion has emerged as an important player on the national and international scenes. Now, I think it's too early to tell how permanent this resurgence of religion will be. The processes of secularization may well continue, though likely not in the older sense of an overall decline in religious observance, but rather in the newer sense of the diminishing influence of religion in contemporary societies or social structures. Nevertheless, religion is presently alive and well on the public scene, so much so that the collection of essays entitled Religion, the Missing Dimension of Statecraft, was seen, has become obligatory reading for diplomats in many countries, Western and non-Western. In many people's minds, the resurgence of religion as a political factor has not been for the good. It seems that gods have mainly terror on their minds, as the title of Mark Jerkensmeyer's book on the global rise of religious violence, published before 9/11, suggests. Among the intellectual elite in the Western cultural milieu, the contemporary coupling of religion and violence feeds most decisively on the memories of the wars that plagued Europe from 1560 to 1650s, and in which religion was the burning motivation, the one that inspired fanatical devotion and the most vicious hatred. It was these wars that contributed a great deal to the emergence of secularizing modernity. A secularizing impact of the wars of religion was felt even as far afield from everyday concerns as theories of knowledge are sometimes deemed to be. As Stephen Tolman has argued in Cosmopolis, modernity, at the epistemological level, did not emerge as often claimed simply as a result of its protagonist's endeavor to dispel the darkness of tradition and superstition with the light of philosophical and scientific reason. It was not accident that Descartes discovered the one correct method to acquire knowledge in a time where, over much of the continent, people had fair chance of having their throats cut and their houses burned down by strangers who merely disliked their religion. A new way of establishing truth that was independent of and neutral between particular religious loyalties seemed an attractive alternative to war fueled by dogmatic claims. As did key figure Enlightenment figures, many contemporaries see religion as a pernicious social ill that needs aggressive treatment rather than a medicine from which cure is expected. Did not the perpetrators of 9/11 terrorist attack appeal to religion as the primary motivating force for their act? In recent war in the Balkans, did not Serbs fight for the land on which the holy sites of their religion stood? Is not difference between Catholicism and Protestantism at the heart of the civil war in Northern Ireland? Is not religion a major factor in clashes in India? The contemporary resurgence of religion seems to go hand in hand with the resurgence of religiously legitimized violence, at least in the public perception. Hence the argument goes, it is necessary to weaken, to neutralize, or outright eliminate religion as a factor in public life. Now, in this lecture, I will contest the claim that the Christian faith as one of the major world religions predominantly fosters violence and argue that it should be seen as a contributor to more peaceful social environments. This may be a bold claim. Lest I be misunderstood from the start, let me clarify my thesis. I will not argue that the Christian faith was not and does not continue to be employed to foster violence. Obviously, such an argument cannot be plausibly made. Not only have Christians committed atrocities and engaged in less egregious forms of violence during the course of their long history, but they have also drawn on religious convictions to justify these. Moreover, there are elements in the Christian faith which, when taken in isolation, or when excessively foregrounded, can be plausibly used to legitimize violence. Second, I will not argue also that Christianity has been historically less associated with violence than other major religions. I'm not sure whether this is the case or not. I'm not sure how one would go about finding that. I will leave these important issues and difficult issues undecided or unaddressed. What I will argue is that at least when it comes to Christianity, and here's my bold thesis, the cure against religiously induced and legitimized violence is almost exactly the opposite of what an important intellectual current in the West since the Enlightenment has been suggesting. The cure is not less religion, but in a carefully qualified sense, more religion. I don't mean, of course, the cure against violence lies in increased religious zeal. Blind religious zeal is at the heart of the problem. Instead, it lies in stronger and more intelligent commitment to the faith as faith. In terms of how Christian faith is conceived, my thesis is this. The more we reduce Christian faith to vague religiosity, which serves primarily to energize, heal, and give meaning to the business of life whose content is shaped by factors outside of the faith, the worse off we will be. Inversely, the more the Christian faith matters to its adherents as faith, and more they practice it as an ongoing tradition with strong ties to its origin and with clear cognitive and moral content, the better off we will be. Put differently, thin but zealous practice of the Christian faith is likely to foster violence. thick and committed practice will help generate and sustain a culture of peace. Now, I differentiate between thin and thick forms of Christian, of embracing Christian faith, and some of you will recognize the distinction between thin and thick. Those of you in cultural anthropology will hear echoes from Geertz. Gilbert Ryle comes even before that. For those of you who are in philosophy, those of you who are in political sciences will recognize Michael Balzer's use of thick and thin. Or those of you who are in ethical philosophy or moral philosophy may find Avishai Margalit's echoes of Avishai Margalit's recent work on this kind of thick and thin and the uses in which they make of it. Basically, what I mean by thick and thin practice of faith is something like that. Thick for me, for instance, is a conviction that a worshiper might express that God is a triune. And if that worshiper understand that conviction, say, is governed by the story of Jesus Christ. Thin would be a Trinitarian faith, say, reduced to something like this. I don't know, some of you will recognize from news a few years ago a sign that goes like this on the Serbian fighters during the war in former Yugoslavia would often flash a sign like this, and it was mistaken by Western media as a sign of victory. It's not a sign of victory. It's a Trinity sign, right, which basically suggests we are Trinitarians and we cross ourselves differently than the pagan or semi-pagan Croatian Catholics do. They cross themselves with a full hand like this. We cross ourselves with three fingers like this, right? If you can stretch out this way, which symbolize Trinity and the two nature of Christ. You've got whole Nicene Chalcedonian content of faith expressed in this flash sign, right? Except that none of it was in the minds of those fighters, right? The Trinitarian symbol served simply as a symbol of cultural difference. Now that's thin, right? Simply a faith as a cultural resource, more or less. I can give more examples of that. So, thin but zealous practice of the Christian faith is likely to foster violence. Thick and committed practice of faith will help generate and sustain culture of peace. This thesis amounts to the claim that approaching the issue of religion and violence by looking to the quantity of religious commitment, more religion, more violence, less violence, is unsophisticated and mistaken. The most relevant factor is the quality of religious commitment within a given religious tradition. So, in the present lecture, I will support the above thesis by countering some influential arguments about the violent character of Christianity. This is only half of what I would need to do to make my thesis plausible, a negative half, right? I'm just going to argue against those who argue that Christianity fosters violence, Christian faith of the heart fosters violence. I would need to do something more positive, right? Show how it contributes, in fact, to fostering peaceful environments, but I won't do that today. That'll be next year when I come and give lecture. And what I'll do is look at the three issues. We could do more, but the three will suffice. One, the argument is Christian faith is violent because it's religion. And religions, by their very natures, are violent. Christian faith being a religion is violent, too. The second argument, Christian faith is a specific kind of religion. It's a monotheist religion. Monotheist religions are particularly violent type of religion for various reasons. Christian faith being monotheist religion is therefore a violent religion. And finally, I'll look at one argument that stems not so much from the general character of the Christian faith, but from one of its particular teaching, namely the argument that Christian account of the doctrine of creation is in itself violent and therefore fosters violence. One could look at other aspects of the Christian faith, especially the account of new creation, right, as a violent, inducive of violence. But I'll leave that maybe for a question and answer period. So, religion, monotheist religion, doctrine of creation, that's the basic structure of my talk. No. The first argument that for the violent character of Christianity claims that religions are by nature violent and the Christian faith being a religion is therefore also by nature violent. Mark Jurgensmeyer's Terror in the Mind of God rests on such a reading of religion. A central reason why violence has accompanied religion's renewed political presence, he argues, has to do with the nature of religious imagination, which always has had propensity to absolutize and to project images of cosmic war. Cosmic war is waged for its own, not for its own sake, of course, but for the sake of peace. Precisely as a phenomenon at whose core lies cosmic war, religion has been, Mark Jurgensmeyer grants that, order restoring and life affirming. But in its pursuit of peace, religion is not, but if in pursuit of peace, religion is not to leave a trail of blood and tears, it cannot be left to its own resources and devices. It needs the temper of rationality and fair play that Enlightenment values give to civil society. So, the argument is, religion, qua religion, is violent to have socially positive role, which it can have, he grants, right? To have socially positive role, it needs to be redeemed by Enlightenment values. Now, the argument that religion, which counts among its great teachers, Augustine and Thomas Aquinas, and even Luther, to name just a few of great theological minds, would need to learn to be rational from Enlightenment thinkers, betrays a rather narrow understanding of rationality, I would argue. But at least such an account of rationality can be made plausible. Implausible is, however, the claim that religion which counts St. Francis among its greatest saints does not have resources of its own to learn about fair play, but must borrow them from Enlightenment thinkers. The pressure to make such implausible claims comes from thinning Christian convictions to general religious beliefs and then placing images of cosmic war at the heart of these. In the process, everything specific to the Christian faith has been lost. So you see another attempt at thinning and therefore associating with religion. Here's another example. Whereas Jurgensmeyer asserts that religion is inherently violent by appealing to the images of the cosmic war, which lies allegedly at its heart, Maurice Bloch argues for the same assertion by offering a general theory of religion. In his book, Praying to Hunter, he argues that the irreducible core of ritual process involves a marked element of violence, of a conquest of the here and now by the transcendental. Basically, the account is something like this. Any ritual process goes along these lines. First part of the ritual process is leaving the here and now going into the transcendental realm. But then second part of ritual process is coming back, re-entry. And that re-entry is a re-entry with the values acquired from transcendental realm and inserting them into here and now. Maurice Bloch argues it's precisely at that point, crucial point of religion, where religion takes the values from transcendental values, brings them into here and now, that religion can and does foster violence. Now, I won't function here as a surrogate anthropologist, because that's not my field. Let's assume that Maurice Bloch has adequately analyzed ritual process. Let's let it stand. I'm not sure that that's the case, but let's let it stand. So, the question still remains whether one should look at the core of ritual process, stripped of the texture as well as the larger context that religion, that concrete religions give it, in order to understand the relation of religion to violence. Here's a thought experiment for you. Imagine that the first part of the ritual, leaving the here and now, by the move toward the transcendental, were understood by a religion as a death to a self, to her own self-centered desires, and her entry into a transcendental space of harmonious peace. And suppose that religion stipulates that the second part of the ritual, the conquest of the here and now by the transcendental, must be achieved in a peaceful way, consistent with the content of the transcendental. If the formal structure of the ritual were filled with the content in such a way, would such a religion serve to legitimize actual violence? Would not the conquest, if successful, be precisely the victory of the transcendental peace over the violence in here and now. Now, as you certainly are aware, such a religion need not be imagined as hypothetically existing. For what I have asked you to imagine is precisely how the Christian faith, at least in some of its important strands, understands itself and understands also initiation, its ritual of initiation, baptism. So, Apostle Paul, for instance, thinks about baptism in the following way. Therefore, we have been buried with him by baptism into death, so that just as Christ was raised from the dead to the glory of the Father, so we might walk in the newness of life. Paul understands walking in newness of life as imitation of Christ, and therefore as repetition in here and now of the transcendental. So he is up for something like a conquest, right? He wants us to live like Christ did live, right? But equally significant as the conquest itself is the character of this conquest, all right? And that character of the conquest goes something like that, like this. Christ died in self-giving love for the godless. Paul must affirm a kind of non-violent conquest of the here and now. To paraphrase Paul's famous summary of Christian life in the world, to seek to conquer evil with evil is to be conquered by evil. Evil can be overcome only with good. So here's a particular account of the conquest, as you see, right? Will Christianity understood in such a peaceful conquest of a violent world by God of peace foster violence? One could argue that any victory of the transcendental over the here and now amounts to violence. But if non-coercive victory of peace over violence is itself implicated in violence, then one may well wonder whether the notion of violence has been hopelessly muddled. Put differently, one would need to show why violence understood in such a way is not desirable rather than objectionable. The whole talk about violence is sometimes suspect, all right? Because it's not quite clear what violence means, right? So one of the things that we need to clarify very carefully is what violence means. And I'm not always sure that violence in this generalized sense in which it is used is so undesirable. Some of you may have been reading, is Slavoj Žižek a name that some of you recognize? He's at Yale, for instance, when he came to give a lecture. I mean, he brought a crowd that was larger than some of the great public intellectuals in this country, and I don't quite understand why. Slavoj Žižek is a Slovenian neo-Marxist, post-Lacanian kind of thinker and cultural critic. But one of the things that he emphasizes very consistently, especially in his recent writings, is precisely that the kind of postmodern critiques of violence have left people without sufficient grounds to engage in ethically responsible political action. And so he wants to retrieve the legacy of Christianity precisely as the ground of engaging in political action. Now, he's an atheist, and he wants an atheist retrieval of Christian legacy, right? Which I don't think is particularly, is likely to be very successful. But nonetheless, he has pointed to something very, very, very significant. He overdoes it, of course. He has a book entitled The Belief. And that book on belief starts with him sitting in a hotel room and watching Larry King show. And on Larry King show, he sees Larry King interviewing Al Mohler, president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, kind of fundamentalist flagship in Southern Baptist Convention. And Al Mohler tells Larry King live that, well, anybody who does not believe in Jesus Christ will go to hell. And now what do you expect Slavoj Žižek does with this? He says, well, exactly this we need to retrieve just in an atheist mode. Right? We need to find ways in which to make a strong claims given the type of world in which we live. Right? Now, I'm not sure that I'd want to go all the way with him on that. He wants a somehow neo-Leninist politics almost. And that's too much for my taste, right? But what is right about what he's doing is the insight that the post-structuralist and post-modernist modes of thought have left us without ability to fund, to ground political activity and moral engagement with the larger issues that face us. And he thinks that the way to retrieve that is to, thank you, he thinks that the way to retrieve this ability is to go back to the Christian legacy. So if you want to read some, The Fragile Absolute is one very interesting book, precisely why Christian legacy is worth preserving. After this digression into Slavoj Žižek, let me return to my topic. So first argument was religion qua religion is violent. Christianity being religion will be also violent. My argument there is, well, it will be violent if you thin it out. If you thin it out to some core ritual process, but if you fill it in with the content of what one actually finds in the biblical text, in that story, biblical story, it's likely to have the very opposite effect. Let's look now at monotheism. Other scholars, like Regina Schwartz in her book, The Curse of Cain, The Violent Legacy of Monotheism, try to argue for the Christian's faith complicity in violence by pointing not so much to the general features of the Christian faith as religion, but to one of its characteristic components. Along with Judaism and Islam, Christianity is a monotheist religion. And therefore, Schwartz argues, it is an exclusive and violent religion. Whether as singleness, this God against the others, or as totality, this is all the God there is, monotheism, she writes, abhors, reviles, rejects, and ejects whatever it defines as outside its compass. Given that the belief in one God forges identity antithetically, the issue is a mistaken notion of identity. It issues in a mistaken notion of identity. We are us because we are not them, and it contributes to violent practice. We can remain us only if we obliterate them. Now, so that's one side of monotheism. In addition, monotheism imports the category of universal truth into the religious sphere. Jakob Jukic, a Croatian sociologist of religion, has noted that this fact lies at the heart of monotheism's exclusivity. I mention Jakob Jukic because he's a good sociologist, and none of you will ever hear of him or read him because he only writes in Croatian. Other folks have made the same point, maybe not as eloquently, but maybe more originally, of course, and you can read their stuff too. Got to promote my countrymen, you know, smart countrymen. To believe that there is only one God means to believe in the one true God. Moreover, since such a claim to truth of the one God must be universal, it is inescapably public. Right? Universal public claims cause strife when they encounter opposing claims of either a particular or universal sort. For this reason, too, monotheism is bound to have a violent legacy, or so the argument goes. We, the faithful, have on our side the one true God and stand in opposition to them, the infidels or renegades. Now, I think this argument should be taken seriously. And yet it is not clear that an affirmation of divine oneness as such leads to violence. Does not monotheistic claim to universal truth work also against the tendency to divide people in us and them? If one accepts the belief in one God, in an important sense, everybody is in, and everybody is in precisely on the same terms. True, being in on the same terms may feel like violence if you don't want to be in, or if you want to be in on different terms. But take monotheism away, and the division and violence between us and them hardly disappears. And if us or them are religious, they each will appeal to their God to wage war. This is, in fact, what happens, whether religion is monotheistic or tribal. In a polytheist context, violence may reassert itself even with more force, because it will necessarily be justified by locally legitimized or arbitrary preferences against which, in the absence of divinity which overarches the parties, there can be no higher court of appeal. Even if monotheism is taken vaguely and abstractly as belief in one God without further qualification, it is not clear that it is likely to generate more violence than polytheism or atheism would. Now, none of the monotheist religion espouses such vague and abstract monotheism. Specifically, Christian monotheism contains a further important pressure against violence, especially violence caused by self-enclosed and exclusive identities of the type criticized by Schwartz. For Christian monotheism is a monotheism of a Trinitarian kind. What difference, you may ask, does Trinitarianism make? One of the socially most important aspects of the doctrine of the Trinity concerns the notion of identity. I think in many ways that's an innovation of the doctrine of the Trinity. And if I want to highlight one contribution the doctrine of the Trinity makes, really, and that's to complexify our understanding of identity. There are other contributions that the doctrine of the Trinity has made to anthropology, which will be very much worth pursuing. One of them, for instance, concerns uniqueness of persons. How does one theorize uniqueness of persons, so that each individual of us is qua such unique and deserves respect. You can find in the Trinitarian teaching resources for that. It's not an easy thing to do, right? Respect to define in what uniqueness of the person lies. If it's something common to all of us, well, how are each of us then unique, right? If personhood is. So you have to find something not that is common to each one of us in which our dignity lies, but you've got to find something that's specific to each one of us that deserves to be respected. Now, this specificity of each one of us that deserves respect, how do you ground that? That's a huge, I think, philosophical question. I think that a theological account of the doctrine of Trinity provides resources for that, but that's a lecture for another time. Again, one more lecture, huh? So the question of identity, this complex notion of identity that you find in the doctrine of the Trinity. Now, to believe that one God is the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit is to believe that the identity of the Father, for instance, cannot be understood apart from the identity of the Son or the Holy Spirit. Father's identity is from the start defined by the other two and is not self-enclosed. So in fact, in God, you don't have self-enclosed identities, but rather richly complex identities. Moreover, the divine persons as non-self-enclosed identities are understood by Christian tradition to form a perfect communion of love. The persons give themselves to each other and receive themselves from each other in love. None has to wrest anything from others, none has to impose anything on others, and none needs to secure himself from the incursions of the other. Far from being a life of violence, the life of divine being is characterized by mutually uncoerced and welcoming generosity. It would be difficult to argue that such monotheism fosters violence. Instead, in Maurice Bloch's terminology, it grounds peace in here and now in the transcendental realm, in God, in the love and peacefulness of the divine being. The argument for inherent violence of Christianity's monotheism works only if one illegitimately reduces thick religious description of God to naked oneness and then postulates some such abstract oneness to be of socially decisive significance. I do not dispute that such reduction in fact happens within Christian communities. I do contend, however, that this is a sign that the Christian faith has not been taken seriously enough because non-religious values have taken precedence, rather than Christianity being therefore inherently violent. So this is the end of my second part on the monotheist character of Christian faith. Let me now take one of the Christian doctrines and see how that, what impact it might have to the violent or nonviolent character of Christianity. So far, I have argued that Christian faith may generate violence in its thin, but not in its thick form. When a thick character of divine being differentiated and complex identity is reduced to an undifferentiated one, and when divine engagement with the world to make a world of harmonious peace is rendered as a generalized conquest. But what about the argument that some very thick and concrete Christian convictions generate violence? Central here is the conviction about the world's creation and also world's redemption. So let me now take this idea of creation of the world. It is a basic Christian claim that God created the world. In her influential book, Sexism and God Talk, Rosemary Radford Ruther starts with the observation that in the Hebrew Bible, the creator is like an artisan working on material outside his own nature. God does so, she argues, by a combination of male seminal and cultural power, word, act, that shapes it from above. In such an account, creation is a result of an imposition of form on formless matter from outside by an alien force. Hence, creation is an act of violence. This is a brief account of how you can construe creation to be an act of violence. Now, what is wrong with this account of creation? Well, everything, almost. Even if we assume that creation is best described as forming pre-existing material, one would have to argue that this material is something and that it is a specific kind of something which deserves respect. But it is not at all clear that chaos, do I pronounce this word? Not chaos, chaos. Is that how I pronounce this word? Yeah, I can never be sure. It's not clear that chaos is actually a something, right? So that on what God imposes the form would be this something. But even if the chaos were something, it is not clear that chaos is something that deserves actually a respect, right? Why wouldn't it not be something analogous to a boulder from which an artisan can fashion an object and a sculpture? For all the sparks flying off his chisel, Michelangelo, working on David, can hardly be described as perpetrating violence. For the activity of forming to do violence, the entity that is formed must possess an integrity of its own that demands respect. If someone were to smash Michelangelo's David into pieces of granite, this would be an act of violence, but not when David makes David, not when Michelangelo makes David out of a piece of granite, right? So the basically idea is forming as such cannot be described as an act of violence. On the whole, however, the Christian tradition has not understood creation as forming. Instead, it has understood that God the Creator is not a demiurge working on pre-existing matter. God creates ex nihilo, out of nothing. The consequence of this understanding of creation for the putative violent character of religion is significant. As Rowan Williams puts in his book on Christian theology, when we say that God creates, we do not mean that God imposes a definition, but that God creates an identity. He continues, prior to God's word, there is nothing to impose upon. From this it follows that creation is not an exercise of alien power. Indeed, that it is not exercise of power at all, understood in the usual sense. Creation cannot be a violent act. Indeed, one may even argue that short of having doctrine of creation, relationships between entities in the world, especially human beings, will necessarily be violent. Consider this. If identities are not created, then boundaries between identities must emerge out of interchanges between these entities. And these interchanges themselves must be described as violent, since boundaries, precisely because they're always contested, must be described as arbitrary from the vantage point that transcends either one of the contesting entities. Given scarce resources, boundaries will always be the products of power struggles, even if those power struggles take form of negotiations. Moreover, no appeals for arbitration between contending parties can be made to something which ultimately stands outside of the power struggle. Put differently, absent the doctrine of creation, which does not impose identity, but which creates identity, we have no resources to think positively about boundaries. Now, one of the, I think, most difficult things that we moderns have, and modernity as a whole has, I would want to argue, is to positively think boundaries. Why is a boundary a positive good? Right? We always think of boundaries as either arbitrary, right, and therefore something that we could also transgress. But if you don't have positive constitutional boundaries, that are a result of not of imposition, but the result of originating definition, you will always have violence in relationship between the entities bound, necessarily bound entities. Because if you don't have boundaries, of course, I'll try to argue this evening, if you don't have boundaries, you have absolutely nothing. So try to imagine a world without boundaries. Just think for a while. No boundaries anywhere. Well, you can't imagine it, can you? You have nothing rather than a world. You have tohu wabohu, you have chaos, right? Because nothing specific can be thought without boundaries. So boundaries and such are positive. But those positive boundaries, how does one establish them without invoking of violence? Okay. So let me, in conclusion, say this. I want to underscore once more that my point in this lecture was not that Christian faith has not been used to legitimate violence, or that there are no elements in the Christian faith on which such use is plausibly built. It was rather that neither the character of the Christian faith as being a religion of a monotheist type, nor some of its most fundamental convictions are violence-inducing. The Christian faith is misused when it is employed to underwrite violence. How does such misuse happen? And how should we prevent it? If we strip Christian convictions of their original and historic cognitive and moral content and reduce faith to a cultural resource endowed with a diffused aura of sacred, we are likely to get religiously legitimized violence and violence in conflict situations. If we nurture people in historic Christian convictions that are rooted in its sacred text, we will likely get militants for peace, if anything. This, I think, is the result not only of careful examination of the inner logic of Christian convictions, it is also borne by some careful look at actual Christian practice. As Scott Appleby has argued in his book, The Ambivalence of the Sacred, on the basis of his case studies, contrary to a widespread misconception, religious people play a positive role in the world of human conflicts and contribute to peace not when they moderate their religion or marginalize their deeply held, vividly symbolized, and often highly particular beliefs, but rather when they remain as religious actors. It's a very important book, His Ambivalence of the Sacred. In conclusion, let me briefly address the question as to why misconceptions about violent character of the Christian faith abound. I have already given part of the answer. Christians have used and continue to use their faith to legitimize violence they deem necessary to deploy. Misconceptions of the Christian faith mirror widespread misbehavior of Christians, and misbehavior of Christians rests on misconstrual of their faith, on thinning its thick and original elements. But there is more to it. For one could easily show that the majority of Christians, I think as a statistically one could show that the majority of Christians and the majority of religious folks in general are nonviolent citizens, peace-loving, peacemakers, some even peace activists, and are such precisely out of religious reasons. The purveyors of violence who seek religious legitimation are statistically a minority among Christians. So why is the contrary opinion widespread? Reasons are many. What Avishai Margalit writes about ethnic belonging applies equally to all religion. It takes one cockroach found in your food to turn the most otherwise delicious meal into a bad experience. It takes 30 to 40 ethnic groups who are fighting one another to make 1,500 or more significant ethnic groups in the world who live more or less in peace look bad. One may describe this as self-inflation of the negative, the tendency of the evil to loom larger than the comparatively much larger good. This general tendency is strengthened in the modern world, whose information flows are so pervasively dominated by media. Consider the following contrast. The Serbian paramilitary who rapes Muslim women with a cross around his neck has made it into the headlines and is immortalized in books on religious violence. Katarina Kruhonja, a medical doctor from Osijek and a recipient of Alternative Nobel Prize for her peace initiative, remains relatively unknown, not to mention the motivation for her work, which is thoroughly religious. As she writes, she became a peace activist when, during the Serbian shelling of Osijek, the recentering of her own self on the crucified Christ freed her will, and she was able to resist the power of exclusion and the logic of war. We know little about people like Mrs. Kruhonja, partly because the success of their work demands low visibility. But our unawareness of them has significantly to do with the character of mass media communication in a market-driven world. Violence sells, so viewers get to see violence without qualms about a disproportion between represented and actual violence. As we know, right, local TV networks in the United States have a certain quota of violence they have to show, whether it's actually happened in inner cities or not, because otherwise the ratings would go down, right? So you've got to show violence, because violence sells, right? Mass media create reality, but they do so by building on the proclivities of viewers. Why does the Serbian paramilitary rapist seem more interesting than Ms. Kruhonja? And why are we prone to conclude from the cross he's wearing around his neck that his religious faith is implicated in the act, whereas it would never occur to us to conclude from the ring on his finger that the institution of marriage is to blame? Religion is more associated with violence than with peace in the public imagination, partly because public is fascinated with violence and religious violence. We, the peace-loving citizens of nations whose tranquility is secured by effective policing, are insatiable observers of violence. And as voyeurs, we show ourselves as vicarious participants in the very violence we outwardly abhor. We are particularly drawn to religious violence because we have understandably a strong interest in exposing hypocrisy, especially of religion's kind. Put the two factors together, inner deployment of violence and delight in exposure, and it looks like we want to hear of religious people's engagement in violence, partly because we ourselves are violent, but expect them to act differently. If we were more self-critical about our own hidden violent proclivities and more suspicious about the presentation of violence in media, we might observe on the religious landscape not just eruptions of violence, but a widespread and steady flow of work that religious people do to make our world into a more peaceful place. Our imagination would not be captured, for instance, with religion as motivating force of a dozen or so particularly zealous terrorists who destroyed Twin Towers, nor a particularly zealous president of the United States right now. Instead, we would be, I don't want to put them on the same level, but nonetheless. Instead, we would be impressed with the degree to which religion served as a source of solace and orientation for a majority of Americans and many other people in times of crisis, with the motivation it gave to many of them to help victims, to protect Muslim co-religionists from stereotyping, and to build bridges between religious cultures estranged on account of violence triggered largely by non-religious motives. It is these anonymous people who acted out of the true spirit of the Christian faith. Thank you very much.
Stimulating lecture. I'm sure that you're all so stimulated that many of you have questions. I'd like to
give you the, I hope it's a privilege of fielding your own questions.
Sounds
I'll
good.
Jump in if there's any trouble.
Okay. To my rescue, right?
So there won't be.
Okay. Yes.
Early on in your lecture, you mentioned that there's at least a possibility that some forms of violence may be beneficial. But then at the close of your lecture, you say that Christian faith is misused when it's made to underwrite violence. What kind of violence are you talking about? And why?
Right. Right. Well, that would be a long question, right? What's the nature of violence? And my sense is that we use the term in rather promiscuously, right? So that any form of pressure becomes violence. So, for instance, that even a reasoned argumentation becomes a form of violence. Now, if you have such a generalized concept of violence where taking a strong stance on something or arguing a particular point can be read as violent, I think it's unuseful. The term then violence becomes unuseful. I'm using it in a more narrower sense where it implies a certain form of, where it implies distinct coercion, right? So I use violence here in terms of coercion, not in this more generalized sense of deployment of violence. Yes? Now, some of you are experts in this field. I should ask Hans to address that question. I mean, he's been working. He's not one of your students? Okay. There's a whole group of students I take here who are dealing precisely in their class with this question. Hans, do you want to say something about it? No.
Don't give me a fool in the spotlight.
Well, I'd like to see how those arguments are developed, and then treat argument by argument, right? Because you can have alternative ways in which one can argue that atonement underwrites violence. Now, my whole work, the exclusion embrace, is predicated exactly on the opposite thesis, right? That it's nonviolence is that the wellspring of nonviolence in the Christian tradition is precisely to be found in the doctrine of atonement. Now I can understand that, say, doctrine of atonement understood as angry father or the father obsessed with enforcement of justice, then needing to punish a third on behalf of setting free the second party, namely us, that such an account of atonement may in fact at least via association foster violence. But I think that would be a mistaken account of even in Anselm's terms, it would be a mistaken account of the doctrine of atonement, because I don't think there's a third party involved. I think that's the crucial question. A crucial point that there are only two parties in the doctrine of atonement, so that taking upon sins is really being judged in our place, self-judgment of a judge in our place, not the placement of punishment onto the third. And if you understand atonement in those terms, I think then it becomes a way in which Christ's death on the cross inspires precisely taking upon oneself violence in order to avoid inflicting that violence upon another, even punishment, which ought to be distinguished, I think, carefully from the generalized term violence. And it's not clear that all punishment must be associated with violence. There was here and here. Question.
Go at it with more conceptual clarity.
Right. No, I don't mean by thicker, conceptually more refined, or even as you suggested now, not just conceptually more refined, but in some way, kind of dogmatically defined, right? My sense would be that there's something much thicker than the conceptually defined doctrine of Trinity. And that's the narrative, the biblical narrative, on which the doctrine of Trinity rests, in which it, in one or the other way, it tries to capture, right? So the thickness is not in conceptual clarity. Conceptual clarity helps you understand the nature of that thickness and capture something of the biblical tradition, which is to say, you don't have to be a theologian in order to have thick understanding of faith. You can be just your ordinary believer reading scriptural texts, and you can have it. And you can possibly have it in a better way. My sense is that the doctrinal formulations are attempts to capture something that's thicker than they themselves are, to set certain boundaries in which that particular thing ought to be understood, rather than they themselves are actually what somehow narratives aim at. It's the other way around.
Do you see anything positive in violence? For example, with World War II, where Hitler was an active in violence and doesn't necessarily listen when the Germans stop, and other countries stepped in to stop him, and that was a violent action. Or with the God of, the Old Testament, how God sort of steps in and is enacted in some violence. How, like, for Christians today, contemporary Christians today, I guess it kind of also relates to a war going on, wherever you stand on that, is there some justified stepping in where sort of peaceful dialogue doesn't work?
Right. I don't think the peaceful dialogue always works. I think that as I read the biblical text, they're predicated on the idea that peaceful dialogues, well, ought to be attempted, but that they often don't work. And so God steps in, right? I have a section in my paper where I talk about God stepping in at the end. It's a major step, stepping in at the end, right, as portrayed in biblical traditions. Can that be described as violent? I differentiate very, very carefully between human violence, human actions, and divine actions there. But behind that, and I think that the divine actions to step in are clearly legitimate. Behind that lies the sense that if violence is not stopped, if somebody doesn't step in, violence is precisely perpetrated and continues to be perpetrated. Now, the question is, what may be our role in this, right? And that's the crucial question. I think it's a pretty consistent testimony of the New Testament that we ought not to imitate God in stepping in, right? That's a divine prerogative. Now, there are situations, then again, I'll tell you my controversial view on this, and you may or may not agree with it. Basically, I think that there are situations which we have to step in, human beings have to step in, but they always have to repent for doing that. God doesn't, but we do. Because such stepping in of coercive type is invariably, when we do it, associated with impermissible types of violence. From inner attitudes to actual actions that we commit, although in a situation of two evils, we may be led to, it may be necessary for us to step in. I know that some people think that it's a very unsatisfactory position to have. I am trying to defend it, partly because I'm interested in religion, religious claims about God not underwriting our violence. Rather, the religious claims here serve to, if anything, let us step back and observe our action and purify both our motives and our actions in which we engage, and we find it necessary to engage. I don't know how to deal with it, frankly. I find that destruction of the Canaanites people not to resonate with what I. With what's found in the New Testament. And one way to do it would be something like this, to say, well, it's really another case of divine violence which uses particular means, right? So it's in no way a legitimation of violence that we may want to do, but rather it's a case of holy war, where the folks are simply the instrument of divine warrior, right? That's how it has been interpreted, and I have some of my questions about that. The other way to deal with it is to assign it to something like a progressive revelation. That's difficult again because it leaves you with, well, at that certain time, God did command that, right? Even if God doesn't command it now, God has change the economy of salvation. Nonetheless, you've got to deal with this. So, frankly, I don't have a good answer to this. My sense is simply that I read those texts from the perspective of the New Testament, rather than the New Testament in light of these texts. And hence, I then say, well, that's not quite right. I know it's not satisfactory, and I don't know, as I said, I don't know quite what's a good answer to it. You'll tell me. Yeah. We need to talk about that too. I'm not sure that I'm fully persuaded by representation in that sense as being violent. I mean, I can see how it can be, right? But I can see also how representation could also be not just not violent, but how it can be enriching, how it can be seen from a different side of something that is from the start understood to be larger than what representation suggests, how representation can in some sense be, to use religious terminology, also iconic, right? So there's a particular window from particular angle to a mystery of something that eludes us, right? And I tend to then think of representation in the biblical traditions in those terms. If we confuse those representations for the can the fullness of reality and therefore nail the reality to representation, well, then certain idolatry that's involved in it and certain violence that is present. And I think we have to guard against that. That kind of violence can take place via pictorial representation, it can take place via narratival representation in various forms, doctrinal especially, it can take a form. And I think there's a critique of idolatry is what we need to constantly be engaged in this regard. There's one comment down here and then... Yes, back. Well, I think it can be. I mean, my sense would be that one shouldn't think of the thick description as... I shouldn't understand the thick description as narrow, right? Within the thick description, there is a broad range of possibilities. And I can understand also, though I don't have fully, I have sympathies with the Anabaptist tradition, and I see also the force of just war theory, and I don't see necessarily that either of these two would necessarily fall outside of the thick description, or maybe a different thick description. In other words, there are plenty of different thick description, but nonetheless, they are some better, some worse, but legitimate. I think on the whole I'm closer to Anabaptist position, but that's... It has little to do with thickness of it, right? But specific reading of the thickness. Hans, and then back there. Chris here.
I appreciate what you said about the goodness of fences and boundaries. If fences are the function and boundaries are the function, wouldn't that require that you're willing to enforce them, that you're willing to use at least some degree of coercion for that, and couldn't therefore violence serve the peace that you're pursuing?
Well, you ought to maintain boundaries. I think that's a good thing. Now the question is whether all boundary maintenance is violent. But presumably boundary maintenance will serve peace, right? Or a particular kind of boundary maintenance can serve peace. Because I can imagine how boundary maintenance would not, right? So you have to affirm that boundary maintenance, qua boundary maintenance is good, and then you ask, well, what kind of boundary maintenance is good and salutary, and what kind of boundaries are good and salutary, right? How firm are those boundaries? How permeable are those boundaries? How hard are they, right? Those are all relevant questions. I wouldn't want to... I hope that boundary maintenance, qua boundary maintenance... I hope it doesn't need to be violent. I mean, in relationship to my wife or to my child, right, Nathaniel, or I have a new addition to family, 8-month-old Aaron, right? Well, there's boundary maintenance happening all the time there, right? and I hope that it's not, can be described as violent, right? I hope that it can be described as life fostering without being violent. Sometimes it's pushing, right? Whether all this pushing is violence, that's the question.
There's time for one more question. My question arises from your comment about the atonement being something that is between two parties rather than three. And you seem to be allowing some healthy play, either to the guilt of sin or violence. Would you given as a just cause,
there are traditions which would argue, which would make that kind of an argument, Kierkegaard being one example of a person who would argue exactly along those lines. In Works of Love, he says, well, the loving one, you know, the person who's the person who loves, if he suffers different kinds of insults and so forth, he or she doesn't even perceive them often, right? It's blind to certain kind of meanness is done toward them because he's loving toward that person. But if that person had a loving wife, she would see every mocking glance of that other person, right? She would perceive the whole situation, how it impacts the self who is blind, right? Because that self loves, and then the loving wife may be quite enraged. Like third party sees much more possibly and can possibly step in. Kierkegaard had a place, of course, also for worldly judges. It's worldly judges who are supposed to act, right? I'm not sure that it's a completely healthy thing not to notice all the meannesses done to you either, right? So I would want to say that one-on-one engagement also. Put differently, the question, Kierkegaard had no room for justice, right? Concern for justice on individual's part. And I think that's not quite right, right? Love and justice can be opposed in such ways so that the concern of the self for its own protection should not be read in negative terms. If the self forgives, self also at the same time blames the other to whom the self forgives, and therefore self engages in certain form of defense. The same, I think something analogous applies to the third party, so that I wouldn't want to have a situation in which so the self is not allowed to do something, but the third party is allowed to do something. I want to have an ethic which would third party and the self would be able to act in accord. And you can do that if you integrate into your notion of love of the others, concern for justice. If you take it out, then you can.
I would like to thank all of you for being part of this, I hope, gentle and positive, thought-provoking event this afternoon. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. And Professor Wolf, we'd like to thank you again for being with us this afternoon. You've got another performance on this evening, which I gather everyone is welcome to as well. We wish you well in that and in your time here in Vancouver. Thank you again for being part of UBC.
Thank you.
Real pleasure.
Pleasure.
Wonderful. Wonderful.